The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show is brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. Welcome to The Money Show. It's Wednesday night. It is a record day for the JSE as we rapidly approach the 60,000 level. Even Bitcoin went over 100,000 Rand today and has sustained those sorts of levels. We're going to be looking at KPMG and the latest company to announce that it will be cutting ties with it. Old Mutual is getting rid of most of its stake in Nedbank. We'll talk about potentially big scandal, and that is if there isn't a last-minute change, VAT could soon be charged on brown bread. It's one of a handful of items, 18 items, I think, which are zero-rated for VAT. But then there were some technical changes made to the VAT laws, and now brown bread has suddenly become vatable. We'll talk about that this evening, and then tetonyati as to what it's like to run the Fenters, old-school South Africa electronics technology business. He was poached from MTN, where he'd just been appointed chief executive, to run Altron. I'm looking forward to catching up with him at 7:30 tonight.
The Money Show,
your number one news and talk station.
Here's today's fast fact with MTN Business. To protect your business, visit mtnbusiness.com/ZA. I'd like to know the name of Sony's mechanical pet. They killed it off about a decade ago, but they've resurrected it. They've resurrected the Sony electronic pet. What is its name? If you think you know the answer to today's fast fact, let me know on our SMS lines, 31702 or 31567, or you can tweet me on @BruceBusiness.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield.
Old Mutual giving up control of Nedbank. Currently, it controls 54% of Nedbank, and it'll reduce that to below 20%. It'll give the balance of its Nedbank shares to its own shareholders, and it's called an unbundling. Peter Moyo is the Old Mutual Emerging Markets Chief Executive. He's on the line to us from Johannesburg today, where they've made this big announcement. This has been in the pipeline for some time, Peter. Why retain any part of Nedbank at all?
Well, hi, Bruce. How are you doing?
Peter, we're good.
Firstly, it was actually announced by Old Mutual PLC that is part of managed suppression. They were going to free up the four businesses, OMM, Old Mutual Wealth, Nedbank, and Old Mutual Emerging Markets, which will be Old Mutual Limited. But as part of that, the arrangement was always that they will sell down from a majority stake to a significant minority. So this is really where we end up at. It's actually been something that Old Mutual PLC had communicated to the market.
I mean, was this always the plan to sell down the stake, to unbundle to shareholders? There wasn't. Was there ever an attempt to find a new shareholder to take up the stake? Some people on my social media feed today suggesting that this is a lost opportunity for Old Mutual to facilitate a very substantial BE transaction with Nedbank.
I will not be able to talk for PLC, but it was always very clear that the way it was going to be done, it was going to be an unbundling to remain with a significant minority. And where we land up at 19.9%, it's still significant, yet it's actually not too big for us. That's really what it all means. But we've had a very long relationship with Nedbank. It's a relationship that we'll continue to have. So we have a very good commercial arrangement with Nedbank on both sides, which is very beneficial to both parties.
Okay, so you mentioned OMAM in the US. You mentioned the life insurance business across Europe. You mentioned the wealth management business in the UK. That's the jewel in the crown for many investors in Old Mutual. What are the timeframes now on completing this, what you're calling a managed separation?
We have always said that our plan is for this to be done by the end of next year. Realistically, what we are trying to do, see how soon we can do it post finalizing our 2017 results. Our 2017 results will only be published round about March 2018. Mm-hmm. So the process really can only begin then.
When do you move into the big gleaming office tower that's being built across the road from the Gautrain?
We should. The first move happens, I think, in about 2 weeks' time.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I've seen the logos going up and I've watched the progress since the foundations were dug about 2 years ago. Are you taking over the entire building? I mean, is the old Mutual emerging markets business sufficient enough to take over the whole building, or will you be subletting some of that space initially anyway?
We're taking substantially most of that. I think we might not occupy one or two floors of that building.
And what's happening to the old building, the old Regal Treasury Bank building, which is currently the headquarters of the emerging markets business? Because you guys got that building for an absolute song when Regal Treasury Bank went bust. You paid very little for it in terms of Sandton property. It's prime property. It's a huge amount of space. Is that on the market?
Yeah, it is. It is on the market. We're selling that property. We didn't get it for a song. I was still at All Mutual in those days when we got it.
160 million rand, it was cheap at the price, wasn't it? Surely you...
No, in fact, we got it for less than that.
You see, you got it for a song. I'm assuming the price tag is a little higher now.
Yeah, no, I think the indications are that we'll get a higher price than that.
I certainly hope so. Peter Moyo, the Old Mutual Emerging Markets Chief Executive. Yeah, the managed separation of Old Mutual, taking it into four bite-sized chunks and dividing it up. And then the business coming back home. I mean, more than 20 years after it went on its global adventure, which has cost its shareholders hundreds of billions of rand over that time. We've seen some very successful internationalizations of South African businesses and some, unfortunately, less successful, depending on what Old Mutual manages to realize for the remaining businesses that it's got internationally. History will be the judge as to whether or not shareholders were beneficiaries of that expansion.
Show. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Well, I like people with good ideas. I hope Damien Judge has got a good idea. Damien, thanks for your call this evening. You got some ideas for the finance minister to improve the economy. Does it involve spending money? Because we've got no money left. I hope you know this.
Evening, Bruce, and thanks for taking my call. Yes, no money needs to be spent to make money sometimes. I think that the finance minister missed a trick a little bit on last week with his speech, where he could have focused a lot on an issue that has been raised time and time again. I think Googling back to about 2009, economists and analysts have recognized policy uncertainty in our environment as a real hurdle in getting investment into the country. And in a difficult time, you know, from a business perspective, if people aren't investing in the business or paying you and your paperwork is not up to date, you get your paperwork up to date so you get the money in. And I think he's missed a real trick there, where we can sit down and with business, with investors, with economists, understand where these policy problems are, sort them out and open the door for investment to start flowing back in.
I mean, I think it's easier said than done in a party that is as divided as the ANC is, with as many ideological sort of pulls and pushes within the ANC. I'm not sure that this is something that's going to come together anytime soon. I mean, he did acknowledge policy certainty was critical. Confidence is the cheapest form of stimulus we could get, I think, was one of the last lines in the medium-term budget policy statement. I think he understands it, but how you coordinate the massive cabinet that is divided and looking to the new leadership at some point in December, I wonder how that's going to play out, Damien.
No, I agree with you. I think the current structure does create a problem and makes it difficult for him to action. But I think if you look at the word crisis, it always jumps people into action. So recently, based in Durban, you saw the floods and the winds and all that took a big toll in the city. And, you know, from a crisis perspective, people quite quickly got policies through the system or projects approved to get things fixed. So, you know, I think we're in a policy uncertainty crisis, and it is a crisis. And if we frame it that way and sit down aggressively to put things in paper and put a plan together, you can make a real difference. And I think the renewable energy example is very clear from both aspects. You know, from 2011 to 2014, when there was clear policy, 200 billion rand flew into the sector. Now 70% of that was local investors. And created manufacturing jobs, created wealth within the within the country, and then 2 years later, it's completely stagnant because uncertainty comes back into the market, and now we've got a plant close to us in Atlantis in the Western Cape that 2 years ago had just been built, and now it's closing its doors and retrenching, all because of policy uncertainty. So
it's nuts. Damien, thank you. Thank you so much for your call. It's great. My producers tell me that Damien's a chartered accountant. So he's thought about this. And ideas for the finance minister to improve the economy. Unfortunately, the finance minister is not like a finance director in a company. He doesn't have that same sort of level of authority in government. He's, like other ministers, reports into the president. And really, it's the president that should be coordinating this sort of stuff, this turnaround in the South African economy, getting the policy certainty, taking the mineral resources minister and giving him a very clear instruction as to how to get a workable mining charter that the Chamber of Mines can agree to, that unions, which have rejected out of hand Mosebenzi's one, is mining charter, how all of that can be brought to book with a little bit of coordination from the centre. But there isn't that coordination. So Damien, I hear you, and you're absolutely right. Policy certainty is pivotal in restoring confidence to South Africa, much needed confidence to South Africa. But without strong leadership at the center, getting cabinet ministers to do what they're supposed to do, I'm not seeing it, certainly not before February. But thanks for the call.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Our fast fact question tonight, and a lot of you actually getting it wrong. I am surprised by you. Sony's mechanical pet being brought back from the dead. What is it called? 31702-31567. You've got a moment to restore some dignity in your household. Chris Stewart from Investec Asset Management. Record days on the JSE. Can you believe? I mean, we were sitting there with the JSE in the early 50,000s, Chris Stewart, 18 months, 2 years ago, saying, can't believe it's so expensive. Can't believe that people are prepared to pay this sort of price for shares on the JSE. And today we are not even a hop, skip or a jump. It's more like a shuffle away from 60,000.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. As we've mentioned in the past, I guess something of a dichotomous market. You've seen a number of stocks that derive the majority of their earnings from outside of South Africa, and in fact outside of the African continent, doing particularly well in rands as a result of the fact that they earn money in dollars and other hard currencies, and on translation that comes back into rands, and they look pretty good. Whilst we've got the domestic economy plays that have done particularly poorly. And actually, on the back of today's record, I went back and had a look. And in fact, the market is still comfortably below the level it was at in 2007, if you look at the JSE in US dollars.
So
you've
got to explain this, because in 2007, the all share index was around, I think it sort of peaked at about 32, 33,000 or thereabouts before the financial crisis. Today, the index level is almost twice that, and you say it's worth less than it was then, huh?
Yeah, I'm saying if you'd taken a dollar and you'd used that to buy the JSE back in 2007, you'd enjoyed the spectacular rand returns you've seen out of the JSE subsequent to that, and that's why we're talking about a new all-time high in the JSE. You then took your rand profits and you converted them back into US dollars, you would have slightly less money than you'd started with in 2007.
That is kind of depressing, because one can measure one's personal wealth in terms of what you can buy in South Africa, and you can't buy nearly as much today for what you could buy in 2007. $10 isn't what it's worth in 2007 today. But if you're going to measure yourself in terms of your ability to be a global citizen, you're poorer today than you were 10 years ago.
Yeah, so I guess it depends on the currency in which you choose to measure your personal wealth. And I guess if you want to have a glass half full day, then look at your rand returns. And if you want to have a glass half empty day, then have a look at your returns in hard currency.
Well, I'm never going to look at them in rands again. Chris Stewart, the commodities driving this market. What's behind commodities?
Yeah, we've seen commodity prices mixed, but by and large, relatively strong. We're seeing the iron ore price coming off a bit the last couple of months, coming down to levels of $58 odd now from $76 a couple of months ago. So we're seeing iron ore price coming off, but still, I guess, remaining better supported than most people had expected. Other commodities, gold price really running to the beat of global macros, and we'll see what happens. You know, I think the gold price will react to U.S. Fed decisions later on this evening, and the appointment of a new replacement to Janet Yellen tomorrow. Will they be dovish? Will they be hawkish? And that will kind of drive what's going on in the gold price. Platinum price showing a little bit of resilience the last few days. Palladium, rhodium remaining very strong. A lot of the metals that back, you know, the move towards electronic vehicles and the movement towards batteries more generally, cobalt and lithium, some of the more esoteric metals showing very, very strong performance. But by and large, commodities holding up better than the market had expected at the beginning of the year. And as a result of that, we're seeing commodity companies you know, trading on fairly attractive multiples, given that earnings are holding up much, much better than expected. And as a result of that, we've seen strong performances out of many, many commodity stocks this year. We've obviously seen Kumba particularly strong, up about 70% for the year. Anglo Platinum up 55%, Anglo American up 40-odd%, sure. Glencore's done well. And this is really because, I guess, at the beginning of the year, there were expectations that commodity prices had peaked and were going to come off quite sharply. And despite the fact that many commodities haven't necessarily gone up spectacularly, they've certainly held up much better than anticipated.
Lots of people on my SMS line are confused as to why Old Mutual is bothering to hold on to 20% of Nedbank, or 19.9% of Nedbank. One of those questions is, you don't need to own a stake in Nedbank in order to enter partnerships with Nedbank. Why would they keep a small stake?
Yeah, I mean, they've indicated today that they're going to dilute down from 54-odd% to 19.9%, and I guess the 19.9% will be significant in that they can, you know, associate account their stake. They will, I guess, still have board representation, but they won't be deemed as being a shareholder of reference, and therefore won't necessarily be the first port of call were there to be a capital call against Nedbank in the future. Now, that's a fairly unlikely event if you look at Nedbank's balance sheet, but, you know, one needs to look far ahead, and back in 2004 there was exactly that. There was a capital call at Nedbank, and Old Mutual had to come in and provide that capital. Clearly, the level, well, not clearly, but I imagine the level has been struck such that they won't necessarily be the obvious, supporter of Nedbank if required, and that will have implications for the capital, positive implications for the capital that they have to hold against their investment in Nedbank. But the point, why would they need to maintain a stake at all in order to, you know, continue the strategic alliances and the, you know, arrangements that they have with regard to Old Mutual providing product into the Nedbank channel, Nedbank distributing Old Mutual product? I guess the belief is that an equity stake, and a fairly credible equity stake, will assist in that regard, without necessarily Old Mutual being able to control what Nedbank gets up to.
There we go. Chris Stewart from Investec Asset Management, thank you very much. Wrapping up today's record-breaking day on the JSE. Nice and strong on the day. The JSE closing within a couple of hundred points of 60,000. Earlier in today's Fast Fact with MTN Business, I asked you to name Sony's mechanical pet that's been brought back from the dead. And many of you tell me that it's the Tamagotchi. Now, the Tamagotchi was this handheld digital pet, and you had to, like, feed it and stuff, didn't you? Otherwise, it died. Wasn't that what a Tamagotchi did? It, like, this little egg-shaped computer. This is far cuter and far more interesting, frankly, than the Tamagotchi, in my humble opinion. It's Sony's robot dog. It's called Aibo. And it's getting a new lease on life. A decade after being discontinued, Sony's brought the mechanical canine back to life in a more cuddly, consumer-friendly artificial intelligence form. And I think Aibo was a little bit one-dimensional previously. You pushed a button and it yapped or whatever it did. But actually, maybe it can learn some new tricks. It isn't. Not an old dog, it's a new dog, so it can learn new tricks. Investors are giving Sony another chance too. Shares in the company rose to their highest level in nearly a decade after the company said it'll have its largest ever annual operating profit. Sony, still very much in the technology game. That's today's Fast Fact, courtesy of MTN Business. And if you think you know your Fast Facts, of course you can join me for the Brutal Biz Quiz on Friday night, where I'll give you 2,000 Rand, courtesy of MTN Business, if you're the whiz of the Brutal Biz Quiz, because they are the ICT provider with end-to-end security solutions. They understand the importance of protecting what helps your business grow. So if you want to protect your business, visit mtnbusiness.com/ZA. This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. We're just going to dip into the House of Lords in London very briefly to catch up with Lord Peter Hayne, who has promised today to address the issue of the Guptas, to address the issue of money laundering. And he may very well name, in the next few minutes, a UK bank he says is instrumental in helping the money laundering project in South Africa. Dipping into the House of Lords in London now via ParliamentLive.tv, Lord Peter Hayne.
By an Indian South African family, the Guptas, and the presidential family, the Zumas. If there had been more proactive and genuine cooperation between the multi-jurisdictional law enforcement agencies and within and between the banks, which have been moving money for the Gupta-Zuma laundering network, the devastation wrought on South Africa could have been significantly reduced. And perhaps the financial institutions involved may have been able to better mitigate their exposure. I had delivered by hand last night to the Chancellor printouts of transactions and named the British bank concerned and asked that he again refer these to the Serious Fraud Office, the National Crime Agency and the Financial Conduct Authority for investigation. This information shows illegal transfers of funds from South Africa made by the Gupta family over the last few years from their South African accounts to accounts held in Dubai and Hong Kong. The last columns of each sheet now in the Treasury show the relevant banks involved. The records show all account numbers used. Many of the transactions are legitimate, but many certainly are not. The latter illicit transactions were flagged internally in the bank concerned as suspicious, but I'm reliably informed that they were told by the UK headquarters to ignore it. That is an iniquitous breach of legal banking practice in the UK, which I trust ministers would never countenance, and is also an incitement to money laundering, which has self-evidently occurred in this case, sanctioned by a British bank as part of the flagrant robbery of South African taxpayers of many millions of pounds and many billions of their local currency, the rand.
Lord Peter Hayne, live from the House of Lords in London this evening, taking on money laundering, not naming the bank, but he says he has, in official documents and an official complaint to the British Chancellor, to the Finance Minister in the UK, has made that official complaint. And, yep, the account numbers are there, the data is there, the evidence is there, and it's all unravelling.
The Money Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
Before we chat to Mark Lamberti, Chief Executive of Imperial Holdings, I just want to dip back into ParliamentLive.tv in the UK, where Peter Hayne, Lord Peter Hayne, previous guest on this show, is explaining why he is taking state capture so seriously. He's naming Standard Chartered as he speaks in the House of Lords live right now. Have a listen.
Enforcement network, shell companies, and I quote, typically have no physical presence other than a mailing address, employ no one, and produce little to no independent economic value. The Financial Action Task Force, established in July 1989 at the G7 Paris summit, has consistently warned that free zones could be used for illicit trade and money flows that fall below the radar of regulatory authorities. We know that free zones have become an increasingly popular mechanism for the UAE and other countries looking to lure international investment and boost foreign trade. But the question for us is whether we're ensuring that our financial institutions are facilitating this inadvertently or not. The misuse by those interests attempting to move their illicit funds from one part of the world to the other in order to facilitate money laundering, mafia crime, terrorist activity and financing, as the noble minister said, and robbery as well. Robbery from taxpayers, as in the South African case.
That's Peter Hayne, Lord Peter Hayne, speaking live in the House of Lords. in London this evening, and Eyewitness News will be all over that story over the next 24 hours, no doubt. Mark Lamberti, Imperial Holdings Chief Executive, explaining at his annual general meeting yesterday as to why he's distancing his company away from KPMG. But just before we talk about KPMG, Mark, I mean, it's really interesting. Lord Peter Hain, using UK banking law, using international regulation, and basically naming and shaming UK-based banks for their alleged role in state capture, is fighting a fight outside the country a lot stronger than is happening inside the country right now.
Yes, it's embarrassing, isn't it? I met with Peter Hain when he was out here shortly, a few weeks ago. And, of course, you see the pressures coming from internationally, from the Department of Justice, the Securities Exchange Commission, from external companies, the head offices of some of these companies that have perpetrated some of the things that have been going on in our country, and the local business community, but nothing whatever from our prosecuting authorities.
Look, I mean, it's glacial here, but Peter Hain is waving a big stick in the UK, and we're grateful for that. It's been about a month since companies started distancing themselves from KPMG. You made your announcement this week that you were seeking to distance yourself as Imperial from KPMG. It suggests that you've taken a very long, hard and critical look at whether or not you should be using its services.
Yes, I think part of it was that the response from KPMG was slow, and we recognized that these two reports are going to take over a year to come out, and we couldn't wait for those. I guess any professional firm could end up with a bad client or a client that turns bad. One could argue that KPMG took a little longer than they should have to resign the Guptas. But the real thing that, of course, concerns us is the SARS report, which cannot be blamed on a single partner or an error of judgment. The ramifications of that report were so great and politically charged that it should have been scrutinized by all of the senior partners of KPMG, and in my view, even by KPMG International. And they never did that. And, of course, now we see the pressure's been raised on trying to get out of the charges against the president on the basis that the KPMG's reports might have been questionable. So all of this has added up, and we couldn't wait any longer.
So what are you doing with KPMG? Are you terminating your contract with KPMG, or simply putting it on ice?
But they're not our lead auditors. We only do about 13 million rands of business with them across the globe. That's in all of the countries where we operate. So they tend to be smaller projects, smaller auditing or consulting projects, sometimes due diligences on acquisitions and things like that. And so most of the things that we have with them will come to an end anyway, as the projects come to an end.
And you won't be appointing them as a lead auditor anytime soon.
No, we won't be appointing them in any capacity until such time as these two reports indicate that they have behaved properly.
I mean, should KPMG shut up shop in South Africa, as some argue they should?
We'll have to see. It's common knowledge that they've got a few large accounts that if they lost those, it would be really difficult for them to continue. I don't think we can call that just yet. Certainly, everyone is going to think twice about using KPMG. And I would also think that most companies are asking their lead auditors whether, in fact, they have any connections with state-owned enterprises that are of a questionable nature, or whether they have any concerns about their previous relationships with Gupta-type companies. So I think the consequence of this is that it's raised questions about all auditing firms, and that's not good for our country, it's not good for our companies.
What about SAP and McKinsey? I don't know if they're service providers to you, but if they are you reviewing those contracts too?
They are, but we think that they've dealt with the thing far better. First of all, they disclosed their own South African situation directly to the Department of Justice and then the Securities Exchange Commission way back in July. They've initiated the disciplinary procedures against the three employees, and what we think was very proactive was that they removed commission on public sector deals in countries with corruption perception indices below 50. Sadly, today's SA is at 45. So, they've taken general action, and I do think that the actions in SAP were confined to a few bad eggs in their employer in South Africa rather than kind of an organizational culture.
Mark Lamberti, thank you. Chief Executive of Imperial. KPMG, not a huge part of their lives, but regardless, they've been cut loose. And Imperial becomes the latest company to do precisely that.
The Money Show on
Number One News and Talk Station.
The Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. Welcome to The Money Show. Tax partner PwC, Charles DeVette on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. A blunder in amending the tax laws mean we could all be paying more for brown bread soon. Charles, what's happened?
Bruce, there was a technical amendment where there was a change to the 2017 bread regulation. But what has happened in that bread regulation is that brown bread is much more, the definition is much smaller than it was in the old days in 1991 when VAT was introduced. So in 1991, brown bread included whole wheat brown bread, high fiber bread, and that was all brown bread. In 2017, there's a new definition that is called brown wheat bread, and then under that you've got the classes of brown bread, whole wheat bread, high fiber bread, and whole wheat brown bread. So that means that the bread that was previously zero rated will now be subject to VAT at 14%.
Is that deliberate? Is it a bureaucratic bungle? What's going on?
It sounds to me as if there was a little bit of noise in the process. I mean, there's no doubt that there was a technical amendment to be made. I think what has happened is that it was broader than anticipated, and maybe a misunderstanding of the big impact of the 2017 bread regulation. It's a linkage between the two acts that is creating the problem. We brought it to National Treasury's attention, but as you know, there's been massive pushback on expanding or this zero-rated list of products, and maybe this was an opportunity to try and limit the base of that.
So when does bread price go up then? I mean, is there any intention to try and reduce the bread price, or is this going to go through?
Currently it's going to go through. It is in the bill that was the tax laws amendment bill that was presented in Parliament by Minister Gigaba last Wednesday, and now we're waiting for our President to sign. So the effective date of the change is date of promulgation, so we never really know when that is. It could be in December or in January sometime.
Sure.
But the moment that the law is signed, then bakers are going to have to start adding 14% on top of the bread price.
Now, is this all brown bread or only certain kinds of brown bread? Because if it's only certain kinds, it creates a massive arbitrage opportunity within the private sector to capitalize on this gap.
It certainly does create that arbitrage. And it makes value-added tax very complicated, because now we need to understand how bread recipes come together as well. So currently, the brown bread itself is quite specific in terms of what it is. And the moment that it's a whole wheat bread that, arguably for health purposes is better for you, then that is no longer a brown bread as defined, and there would be VAT on top of it.
What a nightmare. Charles DeVette, tax partner, PwC. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. It looks like you and I are going to be paying more for brown bread. 14% more, because somebody made a boo-boo, either deliberately or mistakenly. And the VAT Act, it contains a list of 19 food items, now make it 18, because brown bread will be VATed unless Charles DeVette and his colleagues can get that withdrawn. The Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. Yeah, Peter Haynes speaking in the UK House of Lords in the last half hour, saying that he has given names over to UK authorities of banks he believes to be complicit in money laundering. Names, bank accounts, details, times, dates, all of the evidence which is being presented to UK authorities by Lord Peter Haynes. And it's a blooming good job that he's doing it. And thank you to Lord Peter Haynes for doing so. Mark Lamberti saying that he met up with Peter Haynes fairly recently on a visit to South Africa, and his business, Imperial, distancing itself from KPMG, becoming the latest company to do so. So, yeah, lots happening in the world of fighting fraud, and it happens in its incremental bits and pieces. It really does. But, yeah, it was lovely taking the live feed from the House of Lords in the UK on a very particular South African issue. Coming up on your next Money Show, we get to commit an hour of your time to get an understanding about how to use exchange-traded funds in your investment portfolio. So do join me for a live panel discussion. Helena Conradi, the chief executive of Satrix, Candace Payne, who's a strategist and a consultant at Satrix, and Simon Brown, a financial educator at Just One Lap, as we look at exchange-traded funds and how best to use them. Next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show. Business Unusual.
Business Unusual brought to you by those very helpful people at DigiCape, the go-to authorized Apple reseller and your local Apple expert. Start the conversation at digicape.co.za. Business Unusual, Colin Cullis this evening. I mean, I'm just looking at the proposals by Eskom to charge us another 19% on every kilowatt hour that we of electricity we consume from the middle of next year. And then, of course, our local municipality will add their margin on. So it means probably a 25% increase if this goes through. Malusi Gigaba has challenged this and says there's no reason for Eskom to up electricity. But we've been paying multiples of our very cheap 2007 electricity ever since the power crisis. And with all of the corruption and all of the nonsense at Eskom, it really burns me, Colin Cullis, when I look at what the rest of the world is doing in terms of getting energy effectively, efficiently, and cheaply. Tell me a business unusual story around electricity.
Well, this is probably the first one that has been informed by a weather report, but it was a weather report for Europe and in Germany in particular last week that suggested the strong winds blowing through Europe, let's consider those to being the good winds blowing through Europe, would probably allow the sort of fluctuating electricity prices, because it's demand and supply sort of led, that the amount of wind generation would possibly get electricity prices down to zero. And I checked on Monday to see if that was the case, and it did. In fact, they set new records. Germany managed to produce 61% of all the power it needed just from its wind farms. 39,000 megawatts of power was generated. And just for comparison, South Africa has about a generating capacity of about 45,000 megawatts. And that's half of Africa's total capacity. So just Germany's wind farms were capable of almost covering all of South Africa and effectively half of Africa. They also managed to do 25% of all of Europe. So for the rest of the European countries that have got wind as part of their energy mix, they managed to offset the sort of consumption to 25%, which again was another record. And so this evening's one, we look at disruption, and this is the disruption to the electricity industries. And the disruption is not coming from us getting better at coal or even getting better at nuclear, but that the renewables and the prices and the efficiencies have started to come down so dramatically that it really is changing it for everyone. And I'm not to say that I'm negative about nuclear. Nuclear has its place and it's actually very reliable and it's fantastic. It's just that those shifts in renewables is so incredible. And in part, Germany is a very big player for how this happened. So their principal shift started 2002. The unpopularity with nuclear there had been growing over time. And of course, the issues with carbon had seen them want to shift their reliance on it. So 2002, they undertake to invest heavily in renewables. At the time, it's massive stimulus is required, big subsidies. The stuff isn't that efficient and or effective. And it starts improving. It gets to about 2010, and world economic crisis, and the nuclear is just looking so cheap and good that they change their minds. And they say, no, we're keeping our reactors. They have about 19. Then Fukushima happens in 2011. They change their minds again, shut down 7, and they've got 9 left, and they're looking to have all of those shut down by 2022. The nice thing is that besides Germany offering the incentive for people to improve, China, rapidly growing, says we can't just rely on your normal coal. They've got problems with pollution, so they can't rely on that completely. They're also building nuclear, lots of nuclear, but it takes a long time to build nuclear, and there are implications with it. Whereas these renewables, you can spark them up pretty quickly. They come at pretty low cost. They don't have huge capacities. Each individual project doesn't have your sort of 9,000 megawatts or something like that, but you can build them very quickly. And the improvements to the technology and certainly the software for the management, the likes of Elon Musk's and all of these guys, all those sort of winds come together, as it were, and create a perfect storm for where this can all go. And then countries start to really doubling down on it. And, you know, we've heard the line, the canary in the mine, as a bellwether for something that's good or bad. Well, the Canary Islands here might be exactly one to use for a good one. One of the particular islands, El Hierro, it's the most isolated and out of the way. And it spent a lot of its income simply buying diesel to bring to the island to power everything. And they invested in a wind farm and a hydro project and now are completely independent. And so many more countries and typically islands are doing it. So Costa Rica, Uruguay, Paraguay, Denmark, Norway, Germany, Iceland, Sweden, Scotland, all of them have built up their renewable portions of their energy mixes that on occasion, and sometimes for extended periods, they run simply on the renewables.
Why are you telling us this science fiction story in a South African context? Because it could never work here.
Well, that's more good news then, because South Africa, by GDP, back as 2012, we made pretty ambitious projects for what we want to do. The National Development Program has us wanting to add an additional 29,000 megawatts, and 20,000 megawatts is due to be renewables.
No, but we then got a call from Damien earlier, and Damien was just talking about how the finance minister can actually get ahead in terms of his February budget, in terms of improving economic growth without having to spend a cent. And I think Damien was saying we just need policy certainty, and he used energy, coincidentally, to highlight the impact of a lack of policy certainty, talking about the 200 million rand that had been invested mostly by South African companies in renewables. And since then, there's been a backtracking, and now you've got renewables companies in South Africa laying people off simply because we've got such chaotic communication around what our policy really is when it comes to renewable energy.
Which is why I'm sticking with the science, because it's almost impossible for anybody to make an argument that says we shouldn't go this route. And again, this is not because nuclear is bad. It is not that at all. Here's the comparison I'd give you. Imagine you need to make a phone call, and I want to tell you, well, you know what, Bruce, you need yourself a satellite phone. Now, satellite phones can work anywhere on the planet, but are very expensive and expensive to maintain, you know, the costs of making a phone call on them. So I suggest, well, why don't you just get yourself a basic mobile phone? That's all you need. And if it doesn't work so well, we'll just get a new one. And if you're not, you know, the perfect contract, you know, over time, the mobile phone prices continue to drop and the cost to connect to the networks continue to drop. And that's the better option for you, rather than investing in this really expensive satellite phone. And, you know, in the same way that sort of Africa, for the most part, it sort of said, well, we're not going to go down the route of building fixed line communications, we'll just switch to mobile. Then the principles that go through fossil fuels and then maybe add some nuclear before switching to a mix of renewables, we can just give that bypass it. And there are issues with renewables too. You know, when the sun sets and the wind doesn't blow, you've got a little bit of a worry. And, you know, when you don't have enough power to go around, nobody's going to care how wonderful it is for the planet. They want to keep their lights on.
Yep.
But by the same token, the improvements that are happening with battery technology or storage technologies and, you know, salt to use to keep thermal heat in inside it, these are the things that continue to work. And it's not like South Africa is, it's coal power stations switch off tomorrow, or even that Kuberg stops working in the next 5 years. So we've got the base load sort of covered. It's what we start doing that allows the economy to grow,
yeah,
to start getting those prices down, to start giving people a reason to want to say, I want to come and start building businesses in South Africa, where energy prices are reasonable and dropping, where provision of electricity is safe and reliable and all over the show. And the other element that's given with the nuclear build is that potentially be a great opportunity for employment and gathering good skills. Well, you know, nuclear builds are happening all around the world. There is an international market for people who have those skills, but it's not a market that's changing a lot. People don't want to build better nuclear power stations. They want to make sure that they're safe, which means you don't change them. Whereas with the renewables, people are trying crazy new things all the time. So if we can invest in people, both with the provision and maintenance of the current technologies, but also invest in the new technologies, and Africa has a massive potential for rolling out and giving electricity, yeah, so many countries that will benefit from having that access, if for nothing else, to power our mobile phones so we can keep them charged and get onto WhatsApp and do whatever we want to do.
Did I read the story about Germany right, that Sunday Germans got free electricity?
Yeah, so Europe works on sort of a supply and demand. So there's a futures on the electricity prices, and when they predict they're going to have a surplus of energy, then the price to buy that energy is reduced to the point that it could even say, we'll pay you to use the energy. And yes, there was sufficient energy generated on the weekend, and specifically on Sunday, that prices fell to zero. You could use the power for nothing. They would not charge you for running any of your energy needs. That is a Sundance, so fewer people use it, etc.
Yeah, it's not something that happens every day. But I mean, I want to be in a country that takes energy seriously enough to be able to give us a little treat from time to time for being a good citizen who pays their electricity bill. Occasionally, here's a freebie. Wouldn't that be nice?
It is, and I think if Bob Dylan could be quoted here, the answer, my friend,
is Colin Cullis with Business Unusual.
The Money Show.
The Big Five.
The Big Five brought to you by Worksman's Attorneys, your legal specialist for success for the last century, keeping you close for 100 years. Visit worksmans.com. Welcome to The Money Show. So what are the big lessons that we need to take from hosting previous events? The World Cup, Rugby World Cup in 1995. And then we've hosted the T20, and we have hosted the Soccer World Cup in 2010. And we are top of the list of favourites for the Rugby World Cup in 2023. We'll know in the middle of November whether or not we've got the gig. Independent sports sponsorship consultant James Monteith. If this is going to cost us lots of money, we've got to be careful, James. What are the big lessons when it comes to learning from the past so we don't repeat mistakes in the future? Surely one of those must be all around spending.
Absolutely, Bruce, and good evening. I think that Brazil and Korea are great examples of where it actually went horribly wrong. One of the World Cup stadiums that they used for the Soccer World Cup in Brazil is currently being used as a bus terminus and depot. You know, and that's not what we want to see. We want to see that these major venues that we're using for World Cups don't become white elephants after the tournament.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely pivotal, of course. And again, we did well, I think, in 2010 in terms of marketing ourselves as a great destination. And then we kind of forgot that we were supposed to be capitalizing on the Soccer World Cup. And then bad news came around with the Soccer World Cup and the allegations of bribery and all of that. But you've got to leverage these events to get long-term benefits, don't you?
Chris, I think that we have to remember that any World Cup or an Olympic Games or a major global, what they call mega event, is an ideal opportunity for a country to market itself globally. The amount of television time that you get can be quantified in the billions of rands. Now, if you had to go and buy that exposure on networks around the world, it's going to cost you a lot of money. We need to utilize that not just so that the IRB makes money by coming to South Africa, but that South Africa, and in particular the tourism sector, make money after the event. We want to showcase what our country has, and I think that is the major attraction for a country to actually put in a bid to offer these mega events.
Unfortunately, FIFA gave mega events a bad name. I mean, there's still I'm still looking for the huge benefit that was meant to come through from a social, from a developmental perspective from the FIFA World Cup. But it hasn't been as obvious as one might have hoped it would be. And if you're going to host a Rugby World Cup, well, you want rugby to be a bigger sport by 2025 than it was in 2021.
Absolutely. I mean, FIFA left behind $100 million US dollars in what they call the FIFA Legacy Trust. Now, are we seeing any of that money actually being utilized? Granted, there are projects that are happening that happen under the auspices of the Legacy Trust, but one would hope that the social legacy that is left behind after an event is that it actually grows the sport so that kids in rural townships, in rural areas, you know, are able to see the greatest players in the world playing on their home soil, develop a love for the game, and actually start playing.
I mean, the proposal that's been put forward to the International Rugby Board is we've got great stadiums in every significant city. So Bloem's got a stadium and Nelspruit and Polokwane and Port Elizabeth and Cape Town and Joburg and Pretoria and everywhere in between. There is a school of thought, though, that suggests if you spread an event like this too thin, you dilute the economic impact of an event like this.
Absolutely. I think the fewer host cities, the better. You know, if you have a look at our Commonwealth Games, but that sort of didn't really materialize, it's very difficult for just one city to put up all of the guarantees. You do need to spread it around. So, yes, there have to be games in Cape Town, in Joburg, probably Loftus in Pretoria, you'll probably go to Bloem, you'll go to Durban. But do we really need to take games to Nelspruit and Polokwane as well? Because there's a limited pool of funds. And if you're going to be spreading it around eight host cities versus five or six, that potential investment into those cities is definitely diluted.
We've got a problem in South Africa in that we don't trust each other. We don't trust our politicians. Our politicians don't trust business. Business doesn't trust politics. Nobody trusts FIFA anymore. And everybody's like in this quite a high state of nervous tension when it comes for bidding for one of these events. I was chatting to the guy who's pulling it all together for South Africa and looking to make that final push to the 15th of November. I wonder if we can survive a big event reputationally, considering just the high levels of corruption in the country right now.
Bruce, I think that the key has to be transparency. You know, with anything, there has to be a trust from the public that the money that is being spent is being spent in a proper way. I mean, I saw a very interesting stat the other day that the International Sports Court is Sports Court of Law is busier than the ICC, which is the International Criminal Court, and that's, you know, largely indicative of the levels of corruption that we find in global sporting bodies at the moment. And I'm by no means saying that the IRB is corrupt, but we've certainly seen, you know, leaders of FIFA being splashed across front pages for corruption, and, you know, people being ousted out of their positions in a number of different organizations. Now, unfortunately, if there's an element of corruption in those bodies, and there's an element of corruption from be it a government, from a regional or from a national point of view, you know, there's always this perception that these major sporting events are going to be a get-rich-quick scheme. And I think we need to be very, very careful that we don't fall into that trap. You know, there was collusion before the Football World Cup from a number of the construction companies that were involved in the building of the stadiums and those kinds of things. Now, fortunately, we don't need to build stadiums, and I think that's what made our bid so attractive, is that some of them maybe need to be upgraded. We'll probably throw down new turf in a number of them. But we essentially don't need to spend that much money in order to actually host a successful World Cup. And the money that is spent, if we can do that in a transparent way, I think that we will gain the public's trust, and we could potentially run one of the most profitable Rugby World Cups that the IRB has seen.
I mean, this is like asking a rugby player if we think it's a good idea if we host a game, the tournament at home. You have a vested interest as an independent sports sponsorship consultant. But is there any real reason why we should not host the Rugby World Cup come 2023?
Look, I think that if the guarantees that the IRB wanted were exorbitant, then I would say probably not. But, you know, the guarantees that they've asked countries to put down, I think, are actually very realistic. The amount of income that the tournament is projected to make, I think, is realistic as well. So I don't see that there's any reason why we shouldn't. You know, sport has the power to bring people together. We've heard those words many, many times before, and we've seen it happen in South Africa after the 95 World Cup, after the 2010 Football World Cup. So I definitely think that there are more positives than negatives. I think it's a World Cup we can afford, and I think it's a World Cup that we'll actually make money out of.
James Monteith, thank you. Independent sports sponsorship consultant. James Monteith, the big five things we need to learn from the history of hosting global mega events. I'm looking forward. Solo Kubeka, let's get him on. If we get this, Lififi, Tsikiso, Anthony, if we get the World Cup 2023, I would like the next week, if he's available, not too important, Solo Kubeka, the guy who has pulled it all together, to be our shapeshifter, if that's not too much trouble. Thank you. He's been tasked. Mteto Nyati is the chief executive at Altron. He's had a long and varied career, mostly across technology, because as a youngster in the Eastern Cape, his parents kind of figured out this guy's pretty good at engineering, and that was the path that he followed. Mteto Nyati in studio with us. I mean, you grew up in the Eastern Cape, in Mthatha.
Yeah, Mthatha, in Tabase. The village is Tabase in Mthatha. Yes, I grew up there.
There's lots of talent coming to the fore that sort of originates in Mthatha.
I would say generally Eastern Cape, largely linked to the history of this country, because the schools were started there in that region.
You went to a mission school for a bit.
Yes, I went to a missionary school at St. Patrick's Mission for my grade 6 and 7. And
did it damage you? Or did it make you?
In fact,
man,
I was sent there to be fixed, and they managed to do that. You know,
that Roman Catholic school from grade 7 to grade 9. Mm. You went to St John's College in Umtata, another famous South African school, which has bred many successful South Africans.
Yes, yes, that school is a great school in the region. It still continues to be a great school even today. And it was very strong on the science side of science and maths. And in fact, it was in that school that one ended up going to the UK.
You entered the International Science Olympiad, this kid from Umtata in the Eastern Cape, yeah. In 1980.
In 1980, yeah.
I mean, from the Independent Republic of Transkei.
Yes, yes, yes.
In inverted commas, of course. But, you know, you had passport and you traveled.
Yes, and it was quite tricky because where we were in the Transkei, we were not singing this dam in terms of the national anthem. And now as part of the South African delegation going to the UK, one had to sing this dam. It was such a difficult, you know, of course, they had to understand that we're coming from a region which does not sing this dam.
I mean, that set you up then for a career in engineering. Mm. You went to Afrox. Had you been to university yet when you went to Afrox?
Yes. In fact, Afrox, they in my first year at University of Natal, after my first semester, they saw the results. They offered me a bursary. So I ended up being attached to them.
How did you get that first term's fees? Because your mom and dad were both teachers, and then your mom went into business later.
Yes.
But I mean, there couldn't have been a huge amount of money around.
Look, my mom is the one who lifted our family. Because of the business that she was doing, she is the one who puts money aside for that first 6 months, you know. And she was very excited to hear that, in fact, the school, the university gave us all the money back, you know. And from there on, the Afrox took over, and I'm forever grateful to them for that.
Well, what was your mom's business? Because she left teaching to go into the...
Yeah, it was just it's a grocery shop,
okay.
You know, basically, yeah, and selling everything to our village there. And we ended up, you know, I keep asking myself, am I really a morning person, or is it because of that child labor? My mom kept waking us up, you know, at 4:30 in the morning to go fetch the, you know, fresh produce, bread, so that when they open up at 6 o'clock, she's got some fresh products to sell, you know.
Good training for a life of hard work.
When I look back and say, because I used to ask myself, why this punishment? But right now, when I look at the work that I'm doing, I can understand it was preparing me exactly for what I'm doing now.
How did you get into the because you didn't go on a Rhodes Scholarship, but you were chosen.
I was chosen whilst I was at University of Natal. And I said no, because at that time my mother was very sick, and I felt, you know, to go overseas. In fact, I was supposed to go and do masters in engineering and in Germany, and I declined all of that. And in fact, I'm happy.
Was it the right call? I mean,
I'm happy that I did, because I would have ended up being more of an academic, and I don't necessarily think that's what I would have enjoyed. You know,
But I mean, a Rhodes Scholarship, you know, and especially in 1985, 1986,
yes.
for a black South African to get a Rhodes Scholarship was a pretty big deal.
It was a big deal, but it was, of course, my mother was a big deal too.
A bigger deal.
Yeah.
Mom was a bigger deal. And you were a bit scared what she might do to you. I mean, didn't she try and push you? Didn't she try and say to you, just go?
Of course, the parents always do that, but you always have to make your own call, you know, because I remember my parents, they wanted me to do a medicine, and I said, no, I cannot do medicine. I realized then that, oh, no, it was actually my father who wanted to do medicine, and he wanted to do it through me now.
And then you ended up, I love this part of your career, ended up working for Tastic Rice.
Tastic Rice Corporation.
And this is what, the days before Tiger Brands.
it was before the Tiger Brands, yeah. I went, in fact, one of the HR managers at Afrox, who I've worked with, left Afrox to go and join Tiger, to go and join Tastic Rice. And he recruited me to Testigo Rice, and I joined them and became an engineering manager for them, helped consolidate a number of their plants into one big plant in Pietermaritzburg. I was there for like 2.5 to 3 years. And after finishing that project, I said, bye-bye, Pietermaritzburg. Came back to Johannesburg. Sleepy Hollow.
Sleepy Hollow. Unfortunately, I think it's fallen on harder times since then. Then you went into tech and into IT. And that, again, your engineering is important there. Yes. But you went from machines to data and to software and that sort
of thing. There was one company in between, which is key to all of this. That company is NAMPEC. They recruited me from Testic, and they wanted to implement what is called world-class manufacturing. You may remember during those times, it was just after the sanctions, and NAMPEC was going through difficult times. They could not compete with imports, so they're looking for people to streamline their operations and make sure that the products are competitive. And I was one of those people who came in to do that. And it's that work that made me to be visible to IBM, and IBM decided to recruit me.
What's the longest you've ever had a job?
Longest is 12 years.
Oh, okay.
12 years at IBM.
Okay, so IBM was a long phase. Because, I mean, you climbed the corporate ladder really quickly.
Even at Afrox, I was 7 years at Afrox, I don't change jobs like that. The only place where I've changed quick is actually at MTN. Yeah. I was 6 years at Microsoft, 12 years at IBM.
How important was it, though, to spend those long periods there? Because lots of young people today, job hop from salary to salary or career opportunity to career opportunity and don't really ever sort of consolidate their skills base chasing the next buck or chasing the next chance.
You know, when I look at the work that I do today, you know, the base that I managed to get through the skills that I got through those years is something. I mean, you can talk about manufacturing, you can talk about finance, you can talk about whatever field. One is able to go deep in each one of those areas, you know. I may not be an expert in supply chain. I may not be an expert in finance. But because of the work of the time that I took to understand deeply in terms of the roles that I did, it has helped me a lot to ask the right kind of questions. Mm-hmm. And in fact, sometimes people come and bullshit you, you know. And
what he's saying, ladies and gentlemen, sometimes people don't tell you the whole truth.
So you are able to pick up that quickly and make sure that it does not you address it.
Mm. Yeah, most certainly. Yeah. MTN from NAMPEC was from IBM, then Microsoft, then MTN. I've lost track. But you didn't spend very long at MTN. MTN I've been going through quite a tumultuous time.
Yeah,
when you were there,
I spent almost like three years at MTN. Okay. Yeah,
and became chief executive of MTN South Africa before the Fentas came knocking. That is such an interesting opportunity. A great South African industrial company, very old school industrial company, the Eltron group of companies, the Fentas family business listed on the JSE. Mm. And in 2015, Mteto Nyati was asked to go and join Eltron. We'll talk about that in just a minute.
The Money Show. Shapeshifters.
Shapeshifters, Mteto Nyati, the chief executive of Eltron. How did that job come about? Because the Fentas, old school South African family, old school business, fallen on tough times, mm-hmm, I suppose, in mm-hmm. the last 10 or 15 years. Mm-hmm. And what was the attraction?
So they announced, I think, about 18 months ago that Robbie will be stepping down.
Robbie Venter, one of the sons.
Who was one of the sons. And they embarked on a search. And it was through that search that they reached out to me, together with many other people that were part of the recruitment process. And I had to go through the interview process, and it was probably the longest process that I've ever been through. From around April last year to February this year.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Either thorough or not a very good process.
No, it was a thorough process. But at the same time, you have to appreciate that there's something else that happened in the process. Private equity company Value Capital Partners came into the equation around October. And also they wanted to make sure that whoever gets appointed, they've gone through the process themselves. So it was kind of like restarting the process once again.
But also you're coming into an environment, what essentially has been a family business for four decades. And that's kind of hard as an outsider, isn't it?
Look, refer to it more of a family business. I like to say it's more of a family-run business versus a family business because it has been listed and all of that. Mm-hmm. But of course, clearly the culture is still very much that one of a family culture. It's a company that was ready for change. If you look at it, the people internally, they have always wanted to say, they could see that the world is changing around them and they would like to see the company changing, and it was not changing fast enough. Mm-hmm. So what I found that there's a company that was ready for all of the things that I'm doing now. You know,
what are you doing?
6 months down the line, the first thing for me was to make sure that we have a clear strategy, a strategy that talks to the opportunity that is the current opportunity, and look at what's happening in the ICT space.
Because the biggest business within Altron is Bytes, surely. I mean, there must be one of the bigger businesses.
Basically, we had three big businesses. We had PowerTech, you had Altech, and then Bytes. All of them more or less similar sizes, about a year ago, decided to get out of the manufacturing business.
So stop making power cables, yeah.
Yeah, PowerTech became a non-core business. So we basically integrate, that's what I've done, integrate Altech and Bytes. And then, yeah, that's what with Netstar being in there. And so the key focus of management at this time is the disposals, the two disposals that are left, the PowerTech transformers and UEC, and growing the business that is left. That's what we're doing.
Do you miss engineering? Do you miss the puzzle of making machines work, of making things work, making systems work?
I don't miss that because I'm actually getting that. Those challenges every day. They may not come out as machines, but they're coming in the form of people, in the form of systems, you know, and the training that I was given many years ago is the same training that I'm able to apply today.
You look at so many successful chief executives and they're chartered accountants.
Yeah.
And they understand how the numbers work.
Yeah.
And then you go into more industrial companies and the engineers. But the process of being an engineer, and you know, engineers have got an unfortunate reputation of being a bit dull. Because engineers are very process orientated, but that surely is that training as an engineer is a bit of an advantage. Accounting is a process. Engineering is a process.
Bruce, look at the Altron thing. Within a very short period of time, one is able to pick up what are the real issues here. You know, if you are trained differently, it may take you 6 months to understand what are the problems facing this business. But because of the training that I have, you quickly get to the problem. And then you start to align the company to go after the problem, to try and address the problem.
And it's quite useful, I suppose, if you speak engineer. Because like most industries, each industry's got its own language. And if the people who work in the business are technical people, and you speak to them in a way that they get, that makes the job easier.
I would say that is actually one of the problems that the company had, Bruce. It was led by technical people. They grew up within the organization. They ended up managing the company. And unfortunately, those people, the way they are, their makeup, it makes them not to be customer-centric. They are much more into technology. They don't necessarily go and connect with customers. Mm. And you end up being irrelevant in the process, you know. And that is one of the changes that I'm making, where I'm kind of like bringing in people that are very much customer centric.
How many people have you poached from MTN? Because I mean, it's so interesting just watching people's careers, because usually somebody's the pathfinder. They go, and then they go, ooh. Yeah. I know a guy. Yeah. And then they're going to fetch somebody from their previous employer.
Yes.
Have you done that?
I've not done that.
No.
I don't do that. If you go again, if you look at MTN, I did not go and poach from Microsoft, you know. And I'm doing that deliberately, you know. First of all, and when you leave the people, there's kind of an agreement there that, look, you are not going to be taking people away with you. So that's one.
Okay.
But the other thing is that the challenges that you are facing in this new environment are different, you know. So you have to look for people that are much more relevant for this. Not, they may have been relevant in the previous environment, but they're not relevant for this one.
You've got a spring in your step. You're clearly energized by what you're doing.
this is very, very key for both for me personally and for the country. Here you have a company, Altron, that used to be the pillar of strength in the previous regime, really, when it comes to technology. And it used to produce and come up with research on very, very key technology areas in this country.
What sort of things did it do?
For example, the transformers, you know, building transformers for Eskom, building the decoders for multi-choice, you know, coming out with the technology to track cars.
Yeah, tracker, of course. Yeah,
you know, you can name them. We can go on and on. We've got all of that IP. Here you have a company that has got such a great IP, and suddenly it fell off the radar, you know. And my job is to make sure that this company becomes relevant and try and address the challenges that are facing us here, you know.
What's your big dream for the job? What do you want to achieve in it?
What I would like to achieve, first of all, for Altron, I would like to make sure that this company becomes a more global company.
Because you've got businesses in the UK, you've got businesses in Australia. So I mean,
We already have some. We've actually done an acquisition about 2 months ago in the UK to make sure that we have got a bigger footprint there. And so that's one aspect. But the other one is to make sure that this company becomes relevant to South Africa. We've got challenges around things like crime in this country. And the technologies that we have in our company can help address that. We've got problems around healthcare in this country. You know, we've got technologies that talk to exactly that. We've got challenges when it comes to unemployed youth. And we are the expert. We've got a big company that addressing the learning and development. So for me, it's about scaling those capabilities to make sure that we address some of the challenges that are facing this country. And that is what I'm excited about, being relevant to South Africa whilst at the same time growing the company.
Nteto Nyati is the chief executive of Altron. He's been in the job since February. The business that made transformers is itself being transformed.
Transformed.
Nteto Nyati, thanks very much.
Thank you.